All right, we're going to go ahead and get started here today. Thank you very much for joining us. My name is Chris Myers. I'm the Managing Director of the Capitol Hill Campus Program. This is the first of our inaugural 111th Congress events. Thank you for joining us today. Hopefully you have some new faces as well as some old faces here today. Just a quick program note. What the Mercatus Center's Capitol Hill Campus Program looks to do is bridge the gap between academic study and academics in the scholarly environment with policymakers. You guys are trying to seek out the right information, and our model is to bring that information from an academic perspective to you so that you can better analyze policy and make better decisions. This is definitely one of our most popular programs we do during the year. We do four of them. Definitely it's more timely now than it has been in a few years, no doubt. The state of the economy is definitely something that you guys are going to be dealing with probably for a few years to come now. So we thank you for joining us. Just a quick also note that in front of you, you should have flyers for the upcoming events we have through the rest of the month. We're going to be doing tonight a cocktail reception at the Monocle on the Senate side. If any of you guys would like to join us, please do so. Go on the website. I think at this point you send me an email, cmyers2@gmu.edu. We'd love to have you join us this evening. It's going to be from 6 to 7:30, I apologize. Dr. Yanel will be there too if you'd like to shoot some more questions at him after the event concludes today. Also, tomorrow we have our second panel that we're doing with our Financial Markets Working Group. It is going to be exploring a lot of important issues. Dr. Yanel is once again going to be joining us. He's definitely a figure this week with us. He's going to be discussing some of the public choice issues that intersect between industry and public policy when government decision makers have to make decisions on regulated industry. We're also going to have Todd Zawicki do a talk on bankruptcy. We're also going to have a conversation on government ownership shareholders' rights and the relationships that exist there now, especially with large government ownership in a lot of the banks today. Thursday, our final program, it's dealing with economic development. We have a program, the Global Prosperity Initiative, which looks to understand economic development both from a domestic and an international standpoint, the lessons that we've been able to learn from an academic perspective. So we're going to be bringing that to you with two of our best scholars on that subject. And the next week, after the inauguration has ended, we're going to be bringing in Roy Myers from the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and he's going to be discussing the budget process kind of the things that people have been talking about the last couple of years in analyzing how the budget process goes. Sorry about that, but I just want to get that out of the way. Also, if you see those yellow forms, if you could fill those out while you're listening to Dr. Yandel's talk, it helps us to better keep track of how we're doing and how we're performing and try to bring you the best information possible. Let me introduce real quick Dr. Yandel. He's an emeritus professor and BB&T scholar at the University of Clemson, as well as being affiliated as a adjunct professor of economics with the Mercatus Center's Capitol Hill Campus Program. He has a lot of experience in academia and in government, actually, because from 76 to 78, Dr. Yanel was a senior economist with the staff of the President's Council on Wage and Price Stability. And from 1982 to 84, he's also executive director of the Federal Trade Commission. He does these programs four times a year, so we're glad that you can join us when he does do that. But if you can join me in welcoming Dr. Yandel.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you very much. Delighted to be with you to continue a conversation about the economy. If anyone ever wished to be living in momentous times, if anyone in this group made that wish, we got our wish. That is what is going on, at least in your lifetime and mine, in a pretty absolute sense, is unparalleled. We can find pieces of history that match some of the pieces of the current period, but we're in deep water in terms of policy development, and I think it's important for us to always remember that as policy decisions are made, sometimes in the heat of what appears to be crisis, we are defining the economy of the future. We are making decisions that lay a foundation or give a direction to what the economy will be some years from now. It was pointed out in the editorial pages of the New York Times Sunday that one of the major challenges we face today is dealing with Social Security and trying to make that program well and strong. And the writer pointed out that this is something that came out of that Great Depression. It was a major decision that was made, and in a sense, we're still grappling with it and how to get it turned in a better direction than it is pointed right now. So decisions we make that have already been made will give something for a future generation to grapple with 50, 60, 70 years from now. So in that sense, what we're talking about is critically important. The picture is just to set the mood here, and I think I pointed out to the group in October when we were talking that I have a personal interest in that Great Depression because I was a contributor to it. I was born in 1933, and my mother always told me that anyone born in 1933 was not planned, but they surely were loved. And so I got a lot of love in my family. I think it was my sister that really caused the thing. She was born in 29. But we do have these memories, and we know something about the past, and we know something about scenes that we don't want to see repeated, and that's one of them that we have in the background of that slide. So as we talk today, let's talk about recession, depression. What have we got? That is, what is this economic slump, recession? What kind of animal is this we're dealing with as we attempt to describe it and the forces that it brings to us? And then how long will it be? In addition to how deep will it be? When might we see light, we might say, at the end of the tunnel? When will the economic sun come out from behind the clouds? And then what about some of the remedies, and what do they bring? What about the stimulus, and what does it bring? Dot told me as I was preparing this presentation the other night, she said, well, when you get to Washington, please give those good people some good news. And I had to really scratch, but there is some good news. And so let's start off with the good news. Because even though our unemployment rate now slightly exceeds 7%, that says that 93% of the people in this country who want a job have one. There are few places in the world where you can make a statement like that, that we're running at 93%. Now, we'd like to be running at 95% or at 96%. But the difference between where we are now and where we are, you might say, in the best of times, is 2 or 3 percentage points. But the difference, that gap hurts. It hurts. But let's celebrate the fact that we have 93% of the people seeking work employed in this country. That number is going to get smaller as we go forward. That is, those who want to be employed, that number is going to get smaller. Indeed, it could well be that by the time the summer rolls around, we'll be able to say 90% of the people in this country who are seeking employment have employment. That's what the forecast looks like at the moment. Now, in terms of stimulus, one of the largest stimuli that we have received as consumers turns up to be in our billfolds and in the tanks of our automobiles. But the sharp decline in the price of petroleum and then gasoline is the equivalent of a $200 billion annual stimulus that consumers have already received. It did not take an act of Congress to get it to us. We got some other stimuli that way, but this one came through the market as prices of energy were changing. Then the lower mortgage rates that are potentially available to people who own a home and are able to make payments on their mortgage. Given the sharp decline in mortgage interest rates, let's take the 30-year plain vanilla fixed rate mortgage rate, which was at 6.5 and 6.75. It's now headed towards 4. It's in the low 5s right now. That differential is large enough for it to make a lot of sense for a family to refinance their mortgage. The equivalent value of that has a potential of being worth $800 billion in gain for American consumers this year. That is a huge stimulus that is out there. So market forces are bringing us some things. And then the other item of good news, and we'll look at a little bit of evidence on this one, is that finally, when we look at some indicators, credit markets which were locked up, literally locked up, not functioning, are beginning to work not quite as well as they were, but they're beginning to work again. So some of the actions that have taken place and then the passage of time and market forces is delivering something of a remedy to us. A deep, deep question that we may talk about tomorrow, and I'll be happy to brush up against it today, is how did it happen that what was a serious overconstruction and investment in housing in the United States and what got to be called the subprime problem, how did that become a major collapse of the industrial world? How on earth did that happen? And when we ask the question, we know it happened suddenly. So what about the next 2 years? Let's start off looking at what some of the soothsayers are saying for the next 2 years. And I'm showing you some forecasts here, and I have them ordered chronologically so that you can see what has happened. At the very top of the chart are some forecasts by reputable groups, people with reputations, from September. And so you can see what the better forecasters were thinking about the world in September as they made a forecast for the year that has just ended, 2008, and looked forward to 2009. And so in September, we did not have a world recession on our hands. We had a subprime crisis on our hands. And there was some feeling that it was going to be contained. And so what we were going to have was very subnormal positive growth. Then as October rolled around and then you get to November, notice as you look at the 2009 forecasts, by November, those forecasts become zero or negative. And then as you get to December, zero or negative for the year ahead. And so in a relatively brief time, based on the evidence that was coming in, forecasters began to become decidedly pessimistic as they looked ahead. Now, this is through December. My guess is that as we get January's forecasts in and February's forecasts, they will not become any brighter and may not become much more negative. But we have a negative outcome that we're staring at as we think about those forecasts. This is sort of the way it looks when we put it in a bar chart. We're looking here at real growth in GDP. The purple bars represent data that has not arrived, and so that represents an estimate. One of those bars is painted an odd color, and that's to point out that that's the bar that was affected by the tax refunds, the refunds that went out back in the summer, so that we got what could be called an artificial stimulus of GDP, and notice that it went away, that it was a one-time shot of an increase in GDP, and then it goes away when the money went away. And now we're down below zero. Most likely that second bar, when I speak of the second one in terms of data yet to come, this one will probably be even deeper negative than shown in the chart, but it does give you a profile. The profile suggests that by the time we get to 2010 mid-year, we will begin to feel a pulse beat that is fair, but not good. We won't be on the yellow brick road, but it will be a positive growth pulse beat that we will begin to feel as we get to 2010. And so now we're living with this, wondering in a sense, what does this trough look like? How deep is the bottom? And in a little more precise, how long will it last? As we think about remedies, and as you consider stimulus packages and so forth, and TARP extensions, the big numbers, we almost get immune to them as we talk about hundreds of billions and then trillions, and then we read really well-established economist with extraordinary credentials saying it can't be big enough to get us out. In other words, it's unlimited. Just call out the biggest number you've ever thought of, and that economist would say that's not enough. The unfortunate aspect of that is that somebody's got to pay for it. If that stimulus has any value in terms of real purchasing power, it's got to be paid for. Now, what I'm showing you here is one way that we in our community called the United States of America, one way that we pay for things. We pay for them with our savings. And so what I'm showing you here is the personal savings rate. The data start back in 1960. And if you know, and as you look at it, the personal savings rate was about up at almost 10% right in here. When we get down in here, it's zero, practically speaking. That's the fund that was left over after you paid all the bills and you sat at the kitchen table and you say, how are we doing this year, honey? You say, well, it's been pretty tough. We were not able to put much money to one side, but there's some really crises brewing out there and somebody wants us to pay it off. And you say, with what? The only way we can pay it off is with our future savings. So we better get serious about saving some money and putting it away. And I've drawn a circle around the recent data. And as you look at it, you say, wow, America, if you can see that, there has been a sharp increase in savings. A sharp increase in savings in the United States. But let me put some dimensions of those numbers. In 2007, the most recent data we have for a year, the total savings of the entire United States community was $57 billion. That's what it was, $57 billion. And so if we're going to spend $500 billion to get ourselves going again, this is an oversimplification, but it is still a way to think about it. That says, wow, that would take 10 years of future savings to pay that thing off, wouldn't it? Can you think of anybody else that'll pay it off for us? Well, not really. There's not that much altruism in the world, I don't believe. And most of the other folks are suffering too. Now, we can think of some people who will lend it to us. Because that's what we will be doing. We will be borrowing from the rest of the world to take care of these crises. And as we think about borrowing from the rest of the world, then we still get back to the problem, what will be the basis for paying it off? And one basis will be coming out of savings. Now, of course, now let's look at the unhappy aspect to some people's way of thinking. The unhappy aspect associated with this increase in savings is what? What's the unhappy aspect associated with that? They're not spending. And so we have presidents and others saying, America, please get out there and spend. Why? Because we've got to get the economy going again. And what did the American people do? Just the reverse. Just the reverse. They didn't increase their spending. Why do you suppose they increased their savings? And it probably wasn't people sitting around the table saying, we've got to figure out a way to pay off the deficit. I kind of doubt that was in the conversation that night as they sat at the kitchen table. Why do you think they increased their savings so dramatically? All right, they can't borrow anymore. They've been turned down for loans and they're trouble with their credit cards, maybe. But what's another? What's another part of the mix that goes into the decision that says we've got to put some money in the old savings account or somewhere? Fear. All right, unemployment is going up. Your next door neighbor has lost her job. You're hearing about plant closings. And in addition to that, you have testimony taking place in some of the most important places in the world. And what are the people saying in the room? The world's coming to an end. The economic world is going to come to an end if we do not stimulate this economy. And then in some people's minds, as people begin to try to identify what was the watershed point, I noticed that Mark Zandi at economy.com this morning as I was reading his page, they're a pretty powerful outfit, he has identified the bankruptcy of Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae, the nationalization of those two organizations as the event that sent the powerful signal to the world that says, we are in a heap of trouble. Now, those two organizations were nationalized because they were viewed to be bankrupt, but they were bankrupt because of an accounting rule, not because of cash flow. They were bankrupt because of a mark-to-market accounting rule, which is the best practice that is used internationally in accounting terms. They happen to own a lot of mortgage-backed bonds, which they have issued, and other mortgages, And a lot of those mortgages went underwater as market conditions deteriorated. And yes, if you marked to market, they were bankrupt. But the nationalization wiped out the shareholders' equity. And a lot of that shareholders' equity was held by small, rural, and country and community banks who, in order to deal with Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae, were required to purchase stock. And so they had on their balance sheets what they thought was gold-plated asset. In an organization backed by the full faith and security of the American government, and it had value one day, and the next day its value was zero, and all of a sudden you had a group of sick banks where people said, we've got to bail out these banks in America. And then you wonder, why did all of that begin to happen? And that's just part of the picture. Now, here's where the savings are coming from. What we see here is a mapping of the United States savings rate into the price of gasoline. As the price of gasoline went up, notice we got a reverse axis over here on the right-hand side. Here's the price of gasoline, dollar per gallon. That's a dollar and a half up there. That's $4.50 here. As the price of gasoline went up, the amount that we folks out there in the household sector could save went down. Price of gasoline went down, our savings went up. And so not only did we have an incentive to increase the amount we're saving, because of uncertainty, because of fear, we now had a means to increase our savings. And so savings is beginning to build again in our economy, and we're going to need it. And so, you know, one of our questions is, how fast does this thing fall? How deep is the slide? Just to put us in the mood there as we think about this a little bit more. The thing about this collapse that we've had is that it was sudden. And we'll look at some data that will show us just how sudden it was. And when something is this sudden, generally speaking in economics, we would assume that there was some exogenous event, something from outside that happened that shocked this system, that caused something sudden to take place. There's an index that's produced monthly by the Purchasing Managers Association. It is now called the Supply Chain Managers Association, but they still call their index the PMI Index. Comes out monthly. It's for the entire United States. This is for manufacturing. The zero point is 50. That is, as long as the number is 50, you're okay. The economy is sort of moving at a normal rate. If the value is above 50, you're expanding. If it's below 50, you're contracting. And so if you look at this last blue bar before we dropped off the edge. That was August. September is a sheer drop-off. You don't find any kind of drop-off that sheer, that sudden, in the data. In other words, you walked off the edge of the world. That was followed by another drop-off in October, another one in November, another one in December. So we have a shock to the system. If you want to try to find a date when it happened, it would be long about September 15th. That happens to coincide with the collapse of Lehman Brothers. It happens to coincide with the nationalization of AIG, the world's largest insurance company. And so long about middle September, then I've mentioned Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae. Those actions out there in financial markets began to have reverberations showing up now in the manufacturing economy. Now, depending on where you hail from, and we'll see some data as we keep going, depending on where you hail from, the more manufacturing intensive your state or your district, the harder it is hurting right now. And this data right here is enabling you to make that kind of forecast. This is just another view of the same data in the northwest corner. Down below is the rest of the economy. That is, we have a manufacturing piece and we have a services piece. The two together make up the economy. Notice that in the lower panel, down in the southwest corner, this is the services economy. Now, it had a drop-off too. But notice, seldom is heard an encouraging word, but at least we have one for December. Now, no one ever wants to look at one data point and announce a trend. But when you're hungry, as hungry for good news as we are in the American economy, there's a piece. Some people are interpreting this to say the services economy has found a bottom and is beginning to claw its way back. while the manufacturing economy is still weak. Now, fortunately, the services economy is the bigger part of our economy. It is also the part that has the highest wages and salaries. So we've got a little bit potentially positive news there. And, of course, you would expect this in terms of housing starts, but that had been dropping off for a long time. In fact, if we had a longer set of data there, you would see housing starts dropping off from 2005 forward. That sector's been slowing down for a long time, but then it gets serious. Now, as the economy has tightened, as fear has taken over, followed by panic, literal panic in financial markets. By panic, I mean that was the day I drove over to Wachovia, one of the banks I use, and checked to see what the FDIC insurance was on our account, something that I hadn't even thought about in years. That's borderline panic. That was the same week I called my broker at Merrill Lynch. You know, I never thought about Merrill Lynch needing money. All of a sudden, I began to think about Merrill Lynch and how much money they had in the till. So I called my broker and I said, Terry, remind me, please, what kind of insurance coverage do I have on my broker's account with you? I just happened to have my grandchildren's college education fund resting there. And I've made a lot of promises, and I plan to deliver on those. That's borderline panic. You began to see the data in the panic with accounts moving out of banks where there was uncertainty with respect to their credit worthiness. That is, people. I had friends calling me and they said, please tell me the day you decide to go down to the bank and cash out and put your money in a coffee can in the backyard. Would you please call me? Because I'm thinking about doing that. That's panic. And so we had panic that developed in the American economy during this period. As the panic developed, the asset base for banks began to go down. In addition to that, there was $500 billion in overconstruction in housing in the United States. That's the estimate. We invested $500 billion too much in housing. That's the default component. That translates into $5 trillion of losses that get communicated to the banking system. For every dollar you and I put into a deposit, they can lend 10. For every dollar they lose, $500 billion, they lose 10. And so here's this shock that comes to the banking system. As that began to happen, the banking regulators said, look, you guys, you got to tighten up your lending standards. When I call friends who are vice presidents and presidents of banks in my area and I ask them, what are you doing in terms of your lending policy? And they said, let us tell you what we're not doing. If anybody has the word developer or development in a loan application, they are automatically turned down. And it doesn't matter how creditworthy they have been in the past. There's no lending going on for development. By that, they mean real estate development. And so lending standards tightened. There's a survey taken every month by the Federal Reserve Board, and you can see the results, the percent of the domestic banks tightening their lending standards as they try to husband their resources. And here's the reverse of that, vehicle sales in the United States. Tightening lending standards so that people who previously were credit worthy can no longer get a loan or renew the loans that they have. And so we get the tightening, and then here's retail sales. We'll get December data next week. But that's what's happened to the growth, negative growth, of retail sales. And so obviously what we're looking at here is a sick economy. And I hope that you and I, if we were to continue to have these conversations for some time in the future, we would never see anything that looks this sick as we think about our economy. We've got a bad case. Now, how long has it been going on? This is just a reminder that this sickness has been with us for some time, but then it got shocked with the panic. Each month we get data from the Federal Reserve Board called industrial production for the United States. That's all of the output of the utilities, the manufacturers, and the mines in America. And this is the year-over-year annual growth rate, and I'm showing you this to show you that it peaked out back in 2005. Our economy has been sick for almost 5 years now. It didn't just get sick in September when we had Lehman Brothers going down the tubes, and so we were already approaching zero growth. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is that if you're going to have a disease, it's awfully nice for one to come when you're healthy. If you're going to get sick, it's awfully good for you to be healthy at the time the sickness comes. What we've had is an economy that was already sick and weak and now being hit by this panic. That gives you a trend line. It's not real hard to make a forecast as to where the economy was going, and this could be made before the problems that had come going back to last December. Now, how long and how deep will this be? To try to approach this question and to put some dimensions on it, here's what I've done. And this is not to say that, hey, this is science. What it does say, I hope, is that this is a scientific approach to the question. That is, a scientific approach to the question would say, what is the question? What tools do I have available to me? What data do I have command over that would enable me to make a statement about what the future might look like? And so, what I decided was that I would look at all previous recessions in the United States. And so now I'm showing you about four choices there. These are recessions that we have experienced in the United States. This data goes back to 1980 and comes forward. And every time you see a sag below the line, that's a recession. That's that negative period in our economy. And so I studied these and I said, okay, I'm going to pick one and I'm going to pretend that that experience is going to be repeated. And so what I decided to do was to pick the worst recession we have had since World War II. I'm going to say this one we've got right now is going to be equal to the worst recession we've had since World War II. And there it is right there. That's the worst one since World War II. I don't know how many of you were in Washington in 1980, 81, 82, 83. I was. But that was when Mr. Volcker decided to put his foot on the brakes. He was the chairman of the Fed. He decided to put his foot on the brakes. He started doing that at the end of the Carter administration and then really hit those power brakes hard during the first few years of the Reagan administration. Why was he doing that? To get inflation out of the economy. We had had a prime interest rate at 20% plus, the highest prime interest rate in our country's history, because there was so much inflation in the economy. And so Mr. Volcker says, we're going to squeeze it out. And the American people paid one heck of a price to get rid of inflation, and here's the price. That was a deliberately delivered recession courtesy of the Federal Reserve Board. And most of the recessions that we're looking at have been deliberately delivered in an attempt to guard us against high inflation. And so, all right, so I took that data and I said, okay, I'm going to pick this data up right in here. I'll pick that up and I'm going to come over and I'm going to stick it in to the current period. And that's what I've done. So, I started it right in here. Here we go, 2008, August 2008, September. I started right there. There's 1981, September. And so I've stuck it in, I've added it in, and I say, okay, now I'm going to look at that real hard, and that's going to enable me to make a forecast. The forecast, if you see where the data turns up, that happens to be 2010. Now, looking at it, it also enables me to make a statement about how deep the recession will be. Again, assuming that it's like the one in 81, 82. And so here's the picture that you have. The picture says that unemployment in the United States will rise to 8.8% for the nation. 8.8%. It was at 4.4 back then before the recession hit. And unemployment rose by 4.4 percentage points. And so that says we'll see 8.8. It also tells us when we'll see it. We'll see it in June. And so now you begin to put some dimensions. But remember what the assumption is, that this is like the worst recession since World War II. Now, recent data, I'm sorry to tell you, causes me to think that what we've got is worse than the worst recession since World War II. That is, we probably have to add a little bit of ugliness to the data, and I think it's going to be on the depth side as opposed to the length side. I think the length will carry us to 2010, but I have fears that it's going to be deeper than the 80, 81, 82 period would tell us. What about labor market effects? I'm showing you total employment in the United States with a trend line running through it. Here's the last observation. I punched that in at the Tabard Inn last night. That's for December. And as you look at that December observation, notice that there's a pretty good sized gap between it and the November employment. So we're still getting that sheer drop-off. That's part of the pessimism generator that I mentioned when I said I'm thinking that what we're in is going to be worse than the 80, 81, 82 period. Now, people say, well, isn't there something we can do about it? And the answer is, if we haven't already done it, it's not going to happen this year. Those cookies are already in the oven. The cookies for this economy for 2009 are already in the oven baking. It's hard to think of anything anybody can do, and I'm speaking of politically feasible things, that would cause a sudden shift and jerk in the economy before this calendar year is over. I expect we could see some results near the end of this calendar year. But by and large, those cookies have already been made. They didn't put any chocolate chips in them. I'm not sure those cookies are going to be real good. But they are in there, and there's several trillion dollars that went into the recipe. It's already in there baking as we think about this economy this year. But the guys who keep up with recessions are saying, here's where it started. That's December of 2007. Here's December for 2008. It gives you a picture of what has happened to total employment. There's another picture. What we're looking at here is quarterly, the average growth in employment in the United States across quarters. The average across quarters. Here's the last quarter of 2008. Now, if that's not a sheer drop-off, I don't know what is. And by and large, I think that was delivered by panic, not by real economic forces, but by real psychological forces, that we got the panic. The prospects are that this quarter that we're in right now will look a lot like that one, and then we start coming back up. This is a measure of diffusion with respect to employment gains in the national economy. When we are at 50, as many industries and sectors are expanding as are contracting in terms of employment growth. That's sort of a neutral point. Below that, the recession is getting deeper. It is affecting more and more sectors as this line drops. Here's a note of optimism. That slope turned up. Isn't it funny that you would begin to get excited about the second derivative of a function? That is, hey, it's still negative and it's going down, but you say, yeah, but it's not going down as fast. All right. That's gotten to be good news. Jobless claims, where are they in the United States across regions? You can see that the South is the hardest hit, down there where people talk funny the way I do. And you can see the Midwest, and here's the Northeast. Now, it so happens that if you were looking at the services economy, it would be the inverse of that. The Northeast is the heavier services economy. The South is the lesser services economy. It's a manufacturing economy by and large. And so wherever you have the heavier manufacturing, then you've got the greater jobless claims. We look at these outline maps when you and I get together, and this one is for March of 2008. The darker those colors, the higher the unemployment rate. And now what we're looking at is how this slowdown, this panic, this recession generates its footprint across the United States and how suddenly it does so. The northwest corner is for August. Notice how many states went into recession between March and August. Now that's still before the panic takes place. The northeast corner is for September. That's the month when the panic takes place. And the bottom one, this is the most recent data, this is for November. What's left that is not in serious trouble with recession is primarily energy-producing states, whether it be ethanol or whether it be coal from western producers like Wyoming and Montana, or whether it be natural gas or oil. But it is primarily the energy-specialized states that still have a relatively low unemployment rate. Manufacturing is hurting. That's the purple is the worst color. Those are your manufacturing states. And over here are the more seriously affected states by what started it all, the subprime problem. California, Arizona, Nevada. States in recession, this is based on data for industrial production and employment. There really isn't a technically accepted definition of a state recession, but somebody made one up. And here's what it looks like. This is August. There it is for September. There it is for October, the most recent data. And once again, you have these states that aren't in recession, but they are now labeled at risk. Again, it's those energy states as we move along. Now, let's talk about money. That's what's coming out of the 55-gallon drum over there. And we're spilling a lot of it, aren't we? In order for money coming into our economy, that is when the Fed, the Treasury, those have been the primary actors, when the Fed and the Treasury invent new programs, as they have been about as creative as it's possible to imagine, but as they have expanded their lending capabilities, you start off with an organization called the Federal Reserve Board. It's organized in 1916 for the purpose of maintaining the integrity of the banking system. And so there it is, our central bank. As a result of the crisis and the panic, the Federal Reserve Board has expanded its powers in an attempt to overcome these serious negative forces. They're now lending to anybody who becomes a bank. GMAC became a bank. All right. Massachusetts Insurance became a bank. That opened the door to them. And so now we have a number of major firms that have baptized themselves banks. They have done the appropriate things to become banks, which give them access to the Federal Reserve lending windows. In addition to that, the Federal Reserve has said, we will go in and provide a market for commercial paper because the commercial paper market was dying. It was functioning, but not real well. What is commercial paper? That's where corporations, business firms go out and they are lending, they're selling merchandise, they're producing stuff on credit, and they go out and borrow against that paper. That's the commercial paper market. It's short-term lending, but it's the lifeblood of most businesses, and that market had gotten crippled. And so the Federal Reserve said, we will make a market for commercial paper. And so now the Federal Reserve is out lending there. In order to do something about home building, mortgages, home lending, the Federal Reserve said, we will go out and we'll start buying mortgage-backed securities for our portfolio. Ginnie Mae's, Fannie Mae's, Freddie Mac's. And then, finally, in their effort, they did something that has not been done, I would say, systematically. Anytime you say something hasn't been done, somebody's going to say, oh, yeah, but I know a case. Hasn't been done systematically since World War II. And that is an accord between Treasury and the Fed. Cooperation between the Treasury and the Fed so that it's possible, in effect, for the Fed to print more money. It's to develop a lending mechanism as between those two organizations. We had that accord during World War II in order to facilitate the sale of war bonds, to keep the cost of borrowing money for the war at a lower level. It is called the accord in monetary history. So now we have an accord. With all of that going on, we still were not breaking through in terms of this chart until right here. What I'm showing you here is growth of money in the economy. This is the non-bank economy. This is you and me. In other words, the Fed can do all kinds of things. The Treasury can do all kinds of things to announce the opening of windows, new programs, so on and so forth. But if the banks do not lend to you and me, you don't get money into the economy. We've already seen how the banks raise their lending standards. And we've already seen how a typical consumer sitting at the kitchen table said, "Is this the time to go into debt?" No. But finally, we are getting money coming into the economy again. That's that spike that is showing up. M1 is demand deposits and hand-to-hand currency, what you and I have in our pockets for our entire economy. Now, during this period right in here, the Fed was doing everything they could to keep us from borrowing. That was trying to offset this period back here where the Fed did everything it could to get us to borrow. They pumped money into the economy. Some people attribute that as one of the causal effects of the subprime problem. The Fed made an awful lot of money available back there in 2002, 3, 4. Then they put their foot on the brakes. It's really on the brakes, and now it's on the gas, and we're getting money in the economy. That's a positive sign for an economy that is asleep, is that it's waking up, and now we've got monetary forces playing through. The scary side of that coin, along with the other programs that I have mentioned that the Fed and the Treasury have developed, the scary part of the problem might be thought of in this analogous way. Suppose you're out on a camping trip. I'm thinking of a beautiful mountain out there in Montana, where I've spent some time. And suppose we put up our tents and we're out there on the side of that mountain. We've been looking at those beautiful wildflowers for about an hour or two, and we come back to our camp. We had started a fire, but the blame thing is about to go out. And you get down on your knees and you start blowing the coals. And you say, "Hey, go get some sticks, some straw or something. I think we can get this thing going again." That's our economy. So you're down on your knees and you're blowing and, "Hey, I think I'm about to get a flame." And then someone says, "Hey, I think I'll go and siphon some gasoline out of the truck and bring it over." So, "Well, be careful with that stuff. This flame thing could blow up." "Well, I'll put it over here in a can by the fire." And so now you're blowing the coals and this person has this 5-gallon can of gasoline and they take the cap off. That's explosive inflation. And so to get the fire going, we're doing this. The other things that we are doing, the increases in liquidity that is being provided through Treasury and the Fed, the analogy, that's the gasoline in the can. The temptation, of course, particularly if you're getting cold on the side of that mountain, what's the temptation? "Well, let's just put a little gasoline on the fire. Let's just put a little gasoline on the fire." So the temptation is there. And then somebody says, "I think I'll go siphon some gasoline out of my car and put it over here on the other side and over here." That's sort of what we have right now. High risk of inflation in a deflationary economy. The economy is experiencing deflation. We're down on our knees blowing the coals trying to get it to go again, which would reflate the economy. But we've got the gasoline on the sidelines, which might lead to an explosion. Now, this is just another indication. Here's the world bouncing along. This is called LIBOR. That's the London Interbank Offer Rate. If you borrow money, maybe some of you have borrowed money recently, and your loan may be tied to the LIBOR rate. That's a world interest rate. It's a rate that banks charge each other when they borrow over short-term periods. It runs through the London market. Now, here's the LIBOR rate. Just bouncing along, bouncing along, bouncing along. Wow, here's September. Boom! That's the credit market lockup. Well, that's another way of saying, you say credit market's locked up, what do you mean by that? That's what we mean. The LIBOR rate went so high that banks stopped borrowing from each other. And so the financial markets, in a sense, went to sleep. Notice, it has come down. That's the encouraging sign. I mentioned it at the very beginning of the conversation. So, as we look at these things, a couple of other things I wanted to mention and then stop and listen. It still pays to have a bachelor's degree. I punched this data in this morning. This is for December. The unemployment rate in America with people with a bachelor's degree or more is 3.7%. 3.7%. And as is always the case, the people in our country who are bearing the burden of unemployment are the people with less education. Less than a high school diploma, it's almost 11%. So as you look at your own states, your own districts, your own neighborhood, you can pretty well map the seriousness of the economic problem in terms of unemployment by looking at educational attainment data for the population. One last item of really good news. For many, many years now, I have been tracking the price of oil, crude oil, in terms of gold. In other words, the idea is that Arab oil traders demand payment in gold. They don't want dollars, they don't want euros, they want gold. When you look at it that way, inflation is taken out of the picture. Over a long, long period of time, over many decades, the price of crude oil has cycled around that dark line where an ounce of gold would buy 20 barrels of oil. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. It cycles. We've been below that line since about 2000. Invasions, wars, mad people, and so forth have contributed to prices that have been very, very dear. Whammo, the price of crude oil is now back where it typically has been over many, many decades. Those disturbances have hit another disturbance, and that is the recession.